This episode is sponsored by State Farm. You a small business owner looking for insurance that fits your needs and budget? Well, look no further than State Farm. State Farm agents are not just insurance providers. They're also small business owners who live and work right here in your community. They understand the unique challenges of running and protecting a small business. When it comes to small business insurance, State Farm knows what it takes. Create a plan that fits your needs and your budget. State Farm agents are ready to help you choose personalized policies that truly understand your business. Insure your small business with a fellow small business owner. Talk to a State Farm agent today and get started on personalized small business insurance that fits your needs. Like a good neighbor, State Farm is there. Talk to your local agent today. Ready for an awesome episode? Well, so are we. But you know what? Before we get to it, I got to tell you that members of Navy Federal Credit Union could earn more and save more. Bam! Not all financial institutions offer you as many choices for savings options as our friends at Navy Federal do. Start your savings journey with a low minimum deposit. For example, you could open an Easy Start certificate for just $50. And then how many certificates do this? You can then add money at any time and watch your savings grow. To learn more, visit NavyFederal.org. At Navy Federal, our members are the mission. Navy Federal is insured by NCUA, Equal Housing Lender. Membership required. Terms and conditions apply. Loan subject to approval.
Are you crying?
No.
Are you crying? Are you crying? There's no crying in baseball! No crying!
Live from Joe's mom's basement, it's the Stacking Benjamin Show. I'm Joe's mom's neighbor, Duggan. After our long weekend and tons of barbecue rib leftovers, what better than a potluck get together with all of you? Joe's mom's microwaving food, and I'm in charge of entertainment. So today, let's welcome the man behind the New York Times bestseller, Rule One Investing, Phil Town. Plus, as a warm-up act, we'll discuss the fast one that many credit card companies pull on unwary customers. Sure, we'll also make sure to throw out the Haven Lifeline to one lucky caller and, of course, save time for my tasty barbecue-related trivia. Sound good? I thought so. And now, two guys who never need an excuse for a barbecue-related food coma, it's Joe and O-J-J-J-J-G.
Welcome to Wednesday on an abbreviated week for the Stacking Benjamin Show. Hey, everybody. I'm Joe Salcia. I average Joe Money on Twitter and here on Westwood One's exclusive chatty financial talk show, where we do headlines, have a guest,
97.4,
talk about all the new fun stuff coming up in the movie business. We're the exclusive for now. It's Mr. OG. I like calling us exclusive just because I figured out the network doesn't have another one. So nobody told me that we could be exclusive, but if there isn't another one, that makes us exclusive, right?
Sounds like another beginning of a great t-shirt idea for Brad. Exclusive for now.
For now. What a great day. You had a good Memorial Day weekend. We talked on Monday morning, but looks like you made it through.
Yep.
In-laws.
For just a couple of days.
In-laws are still alive.
I'm a big fan of like 4-day work weeks. I like those.
I'm not a fan. I'll tell you what I'm not a fan of. The 5-day work week following the 4-day week. Cause I get to Thursday and I think we're not done yet. Like what's going on here? I don't know, but you know, OG, we need that extra day to pay off our student loans. Big thanks to Student Loan Hero.
I see what you did there.
Yes.
And you're not wrong.
For supporting Stacking Benjamins. If you're somebody who is wondering about all the things going on right now with interest rates and going back to school and loan deferment on some loans, tons to know about student loans right now. So whether you're headed to college, you're in the middle of it and you got to find a way to finish this thing up, or you're somebody who is looking at the other side of it, let's get this stuff paid off quickly. It's all at studentloanhero.com. Great show today. One of our favorite people in the universe, Phil Town, coming down to the basement. I cannot tell a lie. Phil Town, one of my favorite people. The guy's such, I don't know, gentleman, a scholar, a thinker, and he would be coming down to the basement, except of the whole quarantine thing. So we're going to call him on Mom's shortwave radio. But OG, first we got some headlines, so let's get this party started.
Hello, darlings. And now it's time for your favorite part of the show, our Stacking Benjamin's Headlines.
Our first headline comes to us from Financial Planning. You know, now, OG, that a lot of people, Twitter, Square, they were told that they could work from anywhere. Facebook, Mr. Zuckerberg the other day said, hey, you don't have to come into the office anymore, but we're giving you a pay cut if you decide to work from home.
Nice.
Just shows you how the world works, man. Shows you how the world works. But this in from Financial Planning, written by Paul Centropani, 12 affordable housing markets for first-time home buyers. But seriously, OG, if you're somebody who works in a business where you can work from anywhere, why wouldn't you begin looking at affordability now, especially since the chance of you having to come into the office again with future employers is less today than it was 4 months ago?
If you have the flexibility and it looks like you're going to have that flexibility, I'll be interested to see the outcome of this as the coronavirus stuff just kind of begins to unravel. That's not the right way to put that. It's already unraveled.
Yeah. Yeah.
It begins to be put
unraveled.
Re-unraveled.
Yeah, we
get to being unraveled.
How about this? We get to our new normal. We find the new normal.
I don't like that phrase.
You like the new normal?
I refuse to use that. It's against.
You want a phrase that's more of a win-win for us? Got
to
think.
Just trying to
think a little further out of the box.
Yeah, if we could just be more synergistic on our decision making, that would be great. But seriously, what I was thinking about was, if you have managed to be in an organization that hopefully has continued to be successful and your boss has recognized that your section of your organization has continued to be successful, how do you not make the pitch to say, see, I told you I can stay at home, so I'm going to stay at home from now on?
There's going to be lots of statistics about workplace environment changes during this time. I know that there's tons of people in sociology and urban planning doing all kinds of research right now. I can just academics.
The open floor plan concept in the office.
Destroyed.
Remember how that was like, that's the en vogue thing.
Yes.
We used to have a membership at WeWork, and that was, you know, we had like a little office, but they had that whole setup where you could just sit out there and just do whatever the hell you wanted to do.
Sneeze guard salesman giggling by the day.
Exactly.
We're back, honey.
Our time has come.
We are back. I'm not just selling at Subway anymore or the buffet. You remember all that buffet business we're losing? We're getting it back. Affordability, Paul writes, remains the top hurdle to buying a home, especially for those taking the plunge for the first time. And I'm going to stop right there. I don't think that's a bad thing to have to save up for your first down payment. Do you? Like, this idea of making sure that you've got appropriate skin in the game, I think, is a great hurdle to realizing how difficult home ownership really is.
Yeah, it's not supposed to be easy.
And when we make it easy, I think sometimes that's where our big default rate comes from. But anyway, affordability does remain a top hurdle. New buyers, who are generally younger, typically have lower incomes and a shorter credit history, which means they don't often qualify for the best mortgage rates, a study from NerdWallet notes. While these factors are compounded by higher sticker prices, low supply, and the economic impact of a global pandemic, these buyers stand to be pushed out of the market altogether, the report reads. So searching for a starter home can be difficult in major metropolitan areas. So people are looking in new places. So the top 12 in this list, let's get to it, OG. Number 12, Indianapolis. I have to say, I hear central Indiana, and initially I thought, even a guy from Michigan, I thought, nah, not for me. And then I went to Indianapolis. What an amazing town. Fantastic city.
Yeah, Indianapolis, cool town. Absolutely.
Great town. Number 11, another fantastic city, Minneapolis, especially for people who enjoy a short summer.
Yeah, you're saying that a little tongue in cheek, but you're also being truthful. Yeah, absolutely.
I am. But Minneapolis, another very, very nice town. When I was with American Express, we had meetings there a few times. And even during those winter months, downtown Minneapolis, pretty cool with the interlocking habit trail system. Cheese mm-hmm. at the end of some of those halls. It was pretty interesting.
Cheese at some of them.
Number 10 on the list, Birmingham, Alabama. A town I've only been to twice, but what loved it. Thought again, just a nice, fun city. Number 9, surprising to me, is Chicago. Chicago, surprisingly affordable.
Doesn't sound like that's right. Affordable Chicago?
Yeah. Now, the median list price of a house in Birmingham, Alabama was $256,000. Minneapolis, $373,000. Indianapolis, $275,000. You go up to Chicago and it's $316,000. So it's right in there for affordability. Number 8, Philadelphia.
Okay. Philly's a cool town.
Yeah. I'm liking all these so far. Number 7, Baltimore. Our friends at Ortis Academy in Baltimore, Dan, who's a friend of the show, a longtime listener, I know, in the Baltimore area. Number 6 is Detroit. There's that one house just north of town that got sold very quickly. Exciting. Median list price of a house in the Detroit area, $232,000. Hartford, Connecticut. If you want to live on the East Coast, that's number 5. Number 4 is Buffalo, New York. Now you're down to $200,000 for the median list price of a house. Number 3 is Cleveland. My sister lives in Cleveland. And again, another city I didn't know a lot about until she lived there. Talk about some good restaurants. Cleveland bringing it with some fantastic restaurants. Number 2 is St. Louis, where the amazing Steve Stewart lives.
There's some good chow in St. Louis too.
You can live next to him. And number 1, one of my favorite cities, Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania.
Basement. Oh. Pittsburgh. Not the basement.
Number 1. You been to Pittsburgh?
Yeah. Been to Pittsburgh. Don't have any memories of it. So I was younger.
I may have a story about Pittsburgh for later, but I think that these cities, you know, a lot of Rust Belt cities in here, OG, traditional Rust Belt cities on this list. I mean, a few outliers, but generally cities in Middle America. And I'm wondering if this change that we're seeing is going to bring back people to Middle America. Now that you can live.
The reality is that if you can work from home, you get the freedom to pick. We moved across country. You've done it twice. I think most people just underappreciate exactly how awesome that is. I mean, you could put all your stuff in a moving truck in a day and a half, be in a completely different environment without having to tell anybody. You don't have to get permission to move to New Mexico if you want or whatever. You just do it. And that's super powerful. If you've got the flexibility, don't discount it from a financial planning standpoint.
Or instead of putting your stuff in a moving truck, just sell it all.
Well, that's one way to do it.
Our second headline comes to us from CNET. I think of CNET, I think of electronics. But this is written by Oscar Gonzalez over there. Credit card issuers start to lower cardholder limits. Did you see this?
Haven't. Uh-oh.
Yeah. It appears everybody's tightening their belts during the coronavirus pandemic, even credit card companies. A new survey found that about 25% of card owners in the U.S. had their limits reduced or accounts closed within the past 30 days. You might not have the credit that you thought that you had. This is always the first problem I see when people say, hey, I'm not going to keep an emergency fund, OG. I'm just going to keep a few credit cards open. Happened in 2008. Looks like it's happening again now.
Yeah, you can't count on it. And the problem is that in very short order, that spirals out of control. And what I mean by that is, let's say you have three credit cards and they all have a $10,000 available limit. And on one of those, you have $2,500 charged. That might even be your normal spending, by the way, but that's just what's reported. So perfectly fine, right? $2,500 against $30,000, if that's your normal spending. If that card says, yeah, we're going to cut your limit down to 5K. All of a sudden, now you're at 50%. And because of everything is run by all these bleepity bleepity computers, all of a sudden, the rest of those other cards that you have open go, whoa, what happened? All of a sudden, he's using 50% of his credit. Uh-oh, we better reduce our availability to him as well.
Dominoes.
And now you've got three cards that went from 30,000 to 15, still the same $2,500. And now your overall utilization has gone up. And so now your credit score is going down. So you can't go get more credit. And even though you didn't do anything wrong, there's nothing in that.
You did nothing different.
You haven't missed a payment. You haven't charged any more. You haven't charged any less. But you look like a bigger risk now to the computers. And you have no ability to control when that happens. I remember this happening to us in 2008. we had some credit card debt and we were aggressively paying it off. He says, gosh, you know what? This is great. But we've got some extra money. Let's pay this off. And if we need to get back to it, we can. And we had, I don't know, I can't remember the numbers, but it was something like, you know, $7,000 on a $10,000 Discover card bill. You know, that's how much we charged. And so we made this huge, like, $4,500 payment. You know, if we ever need it again, we can just hit the Discover card again. And they immediately, as soon as we did that, they're like, thank you for the payment. In other news, unrelated, your credit limit now is $3,200. We're like, but that's how much we have on the bank. We just went from being 70% utilized to 100. We actually got worse.
Even though you paid a bunch of money to the card.
Even though I put $4,500 on it. And it was just so demoralizing. You're like, well, dang, if I'd have known that, I'd just kept my money. So
especially during that crisis,
Yeah.
How about that? The bank says, hey, thanks for the payment. We're cutting you off. And by the way, if something goes bad for you, don't come running
call
to
someone
us.
Else.
Yeah. Don't come running back to us. It's, yeah. It's
and nowadays,
dangerous.
All of these cards are, when you sign up for them, you're giving them permission to run your credit multiple times. Just go look at your credit report and see how many times, you know, American Express runs your credit. They probably look at our credit report twice a month, I bet.
So I'm
automated, of course.
I'm a fan of when I'm setting up my cash reserve or maybe once a year looking at a place like Magnify Money, as an example, to see that I get a good interest rate. But I get frustrated when I see in online forums fairly constantly people comparing interest rates between 1.2, 1.3. I'm getting 1.4. I mean, $10,000 OG between 1.2 and 1.4 is no money. I don't want to be stuck making those decisions. I want to make the big decisions. Having a cash reserve and putting it aside, I think, is the important lesson here, and maximizing your interest rate, which, by the way, the reason I bring that up is the reason why a lot of people say they don't want to have an emergency fund is because look at the low interest rate. I think you're playing the wrong game, don't you?
The way that you want to look at this is that the risk that you take is inversely correlated to the return that you can get. So you have no risk, and this is total safe and secure money. Of course, you're not going to get any return on it. And okay, fine. So you pick the 1.31 and it drops down to 1.2. It's not the end of the world. You're not trying to beat inflation. You're in the ballpark of being correct. And you're right. People do get frustrated and they kind of screw around with this and trying to make $10 decisions. Meanwhile, they should have $20,000 instead of $10,000. You know, they're not making the $10,000 decision. They're making the $10 decision. But it is what it is. You can't have it both ways. You can't have a great interest rate on your savings account and a really low mortgage rate on your mortgage. And you can't have the safety and security of immediate access to your cash and the opportunity for it to go up a whole bunch. Those things have to be inversely correlated. So it's boring. It's supposed to be the bottom parts of the pyramid. Those are the crappy ones. Nobody looks at the first row of bricks in a pyramid and go, oh yeah, that's amazing engineering right there.
But then people ask, why don't I just get rid of the boring parts? If it's so boring, why don't I just get rid of that?
Well, if I'm allowed a further pyramid analogy, thank you for the setup. You can't do it upside down. Because if you don't have the foundation, right, it, everything screws up. All the stuff associated with personal finance, it's meant to be boring. If you're having fun doing this, or if it's exciting, you're probably doing it wrong, you know. So get your boring cash reserve.
Yeah, I think that's lesson number one. Lesson number two, boss says you don't have to head back to work. Maybe it's time to look at some affordable housing elsewhere in the United States. Could be an exciting time for you and life's little adventure. Well, if you're not familiar with Phil Town, he is a multiple-time New York Times and Wall Street Journal best-selling author. Rule One Investing is his top hit. He also is a gentleman who has a fantastic podcast with his daughter that we absolutely love. Phil and Danielle have Invest Ed. He has always been a disciple of Warren Buffett. You look at Phil's track record as an investor, it is outstanding. The interesting thing that I like about Phil is it, well, many, many, many people talk about efficient markets. You can't find good trades. You can't. Phil has always found a way to be a guy looking in a different direction for his security. So get ready to hear something which isn't the same thing you hear every place else. Phil Town on My Dead Shortwave. And here he is. Man, I wish we were hanging out in the basement like last time, but it's our good friend Phil Town back. How are you, man?
I'm really good, Joe. It's great to see you. Now that we're on the radio, the shortwave, I just want to know if I have to say over. Over?
Yeah, at the end of every set. We'll just annoy the hell out of people. Over? Do you think that's annoying? Over?
Wait, I was supposed to speak next. Over.
Sorry. You're over. That's right. I said over. See, I messed it up right away. I don't even have it.
Joe, come in. You're 5x5. Talk to me.
I am so glad you're here, though, because, you know, not to get serious right away, but we've seen what's gone on in the economy. You're always watching the numbers. I was watching a video that you and Danielle did a couple weeks ago. I want to start with this. You've always said, Phil, that you should listen to smart people. And I'm wondering, when there's chaos all around us like now, who do you identify as those smart people we should be listening to? And how do you kind of, like, what's the Phil Town filter about who we should be listening to and who we shouldn't be listening to during all this stuff?
Yeah, well, first, you honestly did not send me that question.
I don't think I sent you any questions.
This is a really, you didn't send me any questions. And yet, I have an answer. This is something I've thought about a lot for my own students. And so I've directed everybody to two people I think are really phenomenal. The first one is Warren Buffett and what he's saying about what's going on out there. And the second one is Ray Dalio. They're not saying exactly the same things, but I can give you a brief rundown on what I think they're saying. And what I would do if I wanted to kind of get up onto speed with these guys is I would go to a YouTube video of somebody who's recorded Buffett's last annual report thing that he does once a year, and he just did it a week ago. And that was really interesting because it was very different Warren Buffett than I've ever seen. And then Ray Dalio, just Google Ray Dalio principles and you'll get to his website where he is posting up on LinkedIn and on his own website a full series of basically what's coming. And Ray, if listeners aren't aware, is one of the best investors in the world. He averaged 18% per year now for 36 years. And he runs about a $200 billion fund. So it's one of the biggest in the world called Bridgewater. He's a massively respected macro investor. So he doesn't invest the way Buffett does. He looks at what's going on all over the world and he places his bets and their bets into different buckets and tries to make sure that he's kind of understands the whole picture worldwide and where things are going as best as it could be understood. And he is putting out a series. So we'll start with him for a second. He's put out a series now where essentially what he's saying is that we are at the end of a long credit cycle that's lasted about 100 years. And that at the end of these long credit cycles, what happens is you've built up so much debt and so many issues with regard to preventing the last problems from becoming terminal, that you finally arrive at a place where basically your problems are terminal. You have to have some giant recalibration happen. And it usually happens in the form of a depression that's driven by currency devaluations. He points out that every single currency in the history of the world has gone through this. And the United States dollar has gone through this. We went through it in the 1930s. And that effectively we are in the 1930s now, both in terms of what's going on with the stock market, what's going on with the Federal Reserve response to the stock market and the federal government's response to it all. And if you want to calibrate where things are going, that's a really good model. Just look at 1931, 32, and it'll help you anticipate what problems may be coming in the near future.
So I hear the economic numbers come out. And I believe that. And I've been listening to some Ray Dalio myself. But then I see the stock market right now. And, you know, we at Greenspan several years ago talk about irrational exuberance. And we've got a stock market that seems to be trying to tell us right now, Phil, 12 months from now, we're okay, bud. Everything's going to be just fine.
That's exactly right, what it's trying to tell us. But the stock market is really actually extremely bad at looking down the road 12 months because of the nature of the job of a fund manager. And the fund managers now run about 85% of the money in the stock market. So we're talking about the management class that is putting their money in and taking the money out, trying to protect their careers. So think about the job of a fund manager that has $20 billion to manage. And most of that is pension money, insurance fund money. In other words, it's professional money that ultimately comes from little guys, right? Like you and me. And then we put it in our 401k and it ends up in the hands of a pension fund manager who is a pro at picking people to manage that money on a day-to-day basis. And now he's looking at you, Joe, and he's saying, okay, I'm going to give you $100 million. It's a pittance, I know, but you take it and manage it because I like your track record. I like what you do. And I'm looking across the broad spectrum of 50 managers I'm giving money to, and you fill a gap. But there's a lot of guys who compete with you in your gap that you fill. Let's say you're a long-term manager of money with your strategy. And now you're not keeping up with that peer group on a quarter to quarter basis. And Joe, after 6 months of you not keeping up, I'm taking the money out and there goes the $100 million. And every fund manager knows that's the deal. So, you know, the world of fund managers is littered with cautionary tales of fund managers who try to be heroic, beat the market, do great, become the next Warren Buffett. And, you know, the heap of fired fund managers is littered with these guys. Everybody has learned their lesson. Just keep up with your peer group. And what that means is you need to follow a few rules. The first rule of keeping up with your peer group is don't fight the Fed. So here comes this catastrophic drop in the market, 37% down in a matter of literally a month, and shocking everybody. And then comes the Federal Reserve to step into the gap and pour money. Literally, the view on Wall Street right now is unlimited money, whatever it takes money.
Yeah, it is surreal. It's like Steve Mnuchin's out there with a stack of hundreds, a stack of Benjamins, just, you know, bam, 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 just right, giving them to everybody.
Right. In 2008, they saw how important it was to come in relatively quickly with $4 trillion and lower the interest rates, but it wasn't as quickly as they could have. And as a result, an entire segment of the financial world froze up. Credit froze everywhere, and it was a near disaster. Now they're anticipating it. So here comes this big crash, and they are on it immediately to shore up the credit markets, put money in the hands of people who can spend it, back up state unemployment with federal unemployment insurance, hand out money to corporations to help them keep people working. So they're actually anticipating a gigantic black hole of capital disappearing here. And they're trying to fill that before it ever goes away, in essence. So they're being very super aggressive, more aggressive than any other central bank in the whole world. And I think that's to our benefit. I'm cheering them on.
Yeah.
Go for it. Because sure, otherwise we're going to have the wealthy standing there wondering why there's a revolution. Everybody else is like, I don't have a job, Jack, and I'm going to come and take your food.
Well, and to your point, somebody said the other day, they said this word stimulus. This isn't stimulus. These are handouts. We are giving, yes, we're not stimulating anything. We are keeping people alive by printing more money.
We're desperately printing money in order to prevent a spiral into a depression. And what they're really trying to prevent, Joe, is fear from gaining the upper hand to where people are starting to make emotional decisions about their money, their jobs, their families. And that's what happened in the 30s. It got very emotional, because 4,000 or 5,000 banks went out of business, taking your entire life savings with them. There was no federal guarantees. People were terrified. And that fear was extremely hard for Roosevelt, and the entire federal government couldn't get us out of the fear, and literally took World War II to have something worse that we all sort of started to rally around. But the fear was so enormous, people were afraid to move. And what you're seeing today is a really aggressive attempt to prevent that fear from starting up. And so I applaud that. But that said, it is creating its own set of issues, right? I mean, when you have cancer, you got to take chemotherapy. When you take too much chemotherapy, you're dead.
To use a little less drastic analogy, I remember in Stephen Covey's 7 Habits of Highly Effective People, you pick up one end of the stick, the other end comes with it, right? The other, yes, end of the stick is going to come.
Now, the other guy that I would love for people to keep up on is Warren Buffett. And he had a meeting a week ago where effectively what he said is, this stick, I don't know which end I'm picking up. This is so confusing right now. And so many possibilities are happening because of the impossibility of knowing how long is this coronavirus going to keep hammering us. Are we at the peak right now? Are we about to have multiple peaks as we start to open up? We don't really know the long-term impact of shutting down economies around the world. We're gonna find out, but he doesn't know. He's basically said, look, my obligation is to keep Berkshire Hathaway a Fort Knox of corporations. And so he's sitting on $135 billion and he's not spending any. He didn't even buy back his own stock when it got down to about $175 a share, which by his own account is a bargain. So he is sitting there. And what we don't know from Buffett is whether he's sitting there leaning toward a view that says this is going to get a lot worse in terms of stock prices before it gets better. And those worse, the stock prices may be worse because so many corporations are going to have really deep problems that can't be solved by government help. If that's why he's sitting on $135 billion, by the way, that's three times more money than he's ever had in his life that he's holding back. And in 2008, he was saying things like, hey, you know, America's great. You want to get in there right now. Yeah, you want to buy these things when they're cheap.
He was doubling down.
Yeah, double down, jump on it. He put in $40 billion into the markets. Today, he's saying very, very clearly, I'm not putting in a penny. I'm sitting on it. I haven't seen anything attractive at attractive prices yet, which effectively means the market was too overvalued. Even a 37% drop didn't put things on sale. Or that the potential here is a lesson from his teacher, Ben Graham, who was investing through the 1930s and in 1929 had cash out of the market brilliantly, and in 1930 put it back in. And Ben's experience was, it doesn't feel any better to put your money in when the market's down 30% and then it goes down 90% than when you just leave it in and it goes down 90%. It feels just as bad. Yeah. So I think Buffett's lesson from his teacher is maybe, and this is kind of reading between the lines, is maybe be patient here. It's going to get bad, and it's going to get bad in terms of stock prices going way down, not recession down, but depression down. And that's kind of the same thing that Dalio is hinting at, that he's already said it. He didn't hint around. He said, we're in a depression. And, you know, you might want to be thinking about investing like you're in a depression. Good news, huh? I mean, this is the cheery.
Well, this is funny because I'm watching this awesome video with you and Danielle. You're walking through very similar territory that you and I are covering. You know, not a ton has changed. First time in a long time, not a ton has changed in 2 weeks, just more doom and gloom. But you follow this up then, Phil, with saying, so all of a sudden the sun peaks out, because all of a sudden I hear Phil Town say, the next 2 years are going to have some of the most amazing opportunities that people could ever see. So explain what we just got done talking about and how we get out of this Mad Max Beyond Thunderdome existence that you just described to me.
Right. So the other thing that Buffett said that's right to that point, Joe, is that America will prevail in this. And what he means by that is that America has tremendous intrinsic qualities. There are some countries in the world that share some of these qualities, or maybe even have a few more of them. But no other country in the world has the economic resources of the United States. And when you add that to the qualities of the people who live here, the kind of entrepreneurial spirit, the qualities that the country has of the people who are here to step out of the box, to find a good solution is extraordinary. And many of those people run public companies. And those public companies have resources. They're getting more resources from the Federal Reserve. So if it were possible to pick a handful, let's say, of astonishingly good companies that should do well, not necessarily well in a depression, but will come out of a depression stronger than they went in, then we have an opportunity here that is unlike anything any of us has seen in our lifetimes. The last time there was this opportunity was in the 1930s. And that is an opportunity when there are fortunes lost to be part of the group where there are fortunes made. And that's the group we want to be in. And the guy that taught Warren made an absolute fortune, billions of dollars in today's currency, in the 1930s through World War II, and he finally retired in 1955. And he did it just following some very simple principles of investing that Buffett's been teaching for 50 years, but which I think many people feel like are too difficult or outside the reach of an ordinary person, or, you know, Buffett's a genius and what he does doesn't apply to me. And you hear that a lot in the financial services industry, right? It's like, well, that's Buffett, you know, that's not the rest of us. But I don't think Buffett thinks like that. I think he thinks if you apply yourself, that this isn't a game where 160 IQ beats 110 IQ. It's not that kind of a game. It's a game where if you understand what a good business looks like, that will be anti-fragile in a depression, that it'll benefit from a depression ultimately by having its competitors go away, by being the last man standing kind of in its industry and come out stronger than ever. Those kinds of companies are going to be on sale in a way in the next 2 years that we have never seen. You're literally going to be able to pick up, if it's like the 1930s, you know, $10 bills for a dollar. And when those $10 bills go back up to their real value, you'll have made 1,000% in some relatively short period of time. Is kind of how the numbers work there, Joe.
I want to ask you about two things about that. Number one is, you know, I've had lots of people reach out to me on Twitter and other ways and talking about, hey, airlines, cruise ships, you're not talking about airlines when you're talking about this diving and going in and buying, picking up some Delta Airlines. You're not going to see Phil Town swooping in and buying that stuff.
No cruise lines, even though Saudi Arabia is jumping on it. No, those are speculative investments. You have to be gambling to do that. And we certainly don't want to gamble with money I can't afford to lose, right? I don't want to lose the money we built over a lifetime. And so what we have to look for are companies that are not being damaged by this whole pandemic and the shutdown that's going on. We want to look for companies that are being strengthened by all of this. They're actually in a better position long-term over time. And that takes a very specific kind of company. And strangely, you can see some of them just take off.
Yeah.
You know, while Southwest Airlines is going down, we can't buy those guys because we don't know what the future holds for them. And airlines are classical Chapter 11 bankruptcy companies. They feel fully justified just going and wiping out their shareholders and starting over, and have done so many times. The only exception is Southwest Airlines out there right now. So we don't know what the future holds for them. Because we don't know that, we don't know what value to put on them. And because we don't know the value, we don't know what on sale looks like. And if we don't know that, we can't buy it. We want to go to a garage sale, but we want to buy things we understand, right? Not just because buy somebody's gold jewelry, you know, or gold chain. We're going to buy the gold chains down there at Miami Beach on 80% off sale here for these gold chains. And if you don't know the value of the gold chains, you think you're getting a bargain, right? Not realizing you can buy those at Walmart for half the price you just bought it for on the Miami Beach. So understanding the value of what you're buying is just fundamental to doing this. And that's not that hard. So, I mean, if you're willing to dedicate a little bit of time to learning this, you're completely able. And here's something else that I think is really important, by the way, because I know you're a former Ameriprise guy. So you've done some of this kind of stuff, right?
A long time ago, my friend, but yes.
Yeah, a long time ago.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
But there's this idea of diversification, right?
Sure.
And that'll protect you.
Well, and that was my next question, because just before this hit, not to cut you off, but I think we're going the same way, which is, you know, Dr. Michael Burry was talking about how an issue with indexing is that right now it's hard as hell to figure out the price. And as more people index, pricing becomes really, really difficult. And it sounds like this is kind of where you're going as well.
Exactly, right? What Dr. Burry is talking about is that indexes, when you purchase an index in your 401k and thus diversify across the entire, let's say, S&P 500 index, you have 500 companies, ballpark, and now you own all of them and you're diversified and you're feeling very, very safe relative to trying to pick stocks yourself. But there's a catch, and the catch is that when you do that, the people running that index, SPY, let's say, have to go out and buy a pro rata share of all of those companies. They're not looking at the value of those businesses at all. Nothing to do with the value. So if everybody indexes and everybody buys the index, it just keeps going up. There's no connection to the cash flow coming off of these companies whatsoever. In other words, it becomes like a Picasso or a gold bar or something. You suddenly have the market being just valued at whatever price people pay for it. And since they're buying the index, they just keep paying more. But that turns out to be a problem. And we've seen that with real estate in the last decade. And that is when everybody's buying something that is in fact a cash producing asset, eventually somebody wakes up to the notion that this thing is massively and ridiculously overpriced. and that I'm not getting enough for my money for the risk I'm taking putting my money in the index. That is, the return on my cash for putting my money there is too low. And this is what happened in real estate. It's like Vancouver real estate got to a point where people were buying Vancouver real estate and getting a 1% yield on their purchase price, right? And they finally realized, you know what? This is way too high. And so they stopped buying it, and bam, the real estate prices go down. So the bubble is there in the market. And maybe the best way to look at that bubble is the Wilshire Index compared to the GDP of the United States, which is a ratio tracked by the Federal Reserve in St. Louis called, if you wanted to look at it, you'd Google Fred, F-R-E-D, and then Wilshire GDP. And it will show you that as long as I've been tracking this, the average relationship between the market, which is the Wilshire Index, and the revenue of America, which is GDP, was about 80%. That is, the market was priced at about 80% of our GDP. So if our GDP is 10 trillion, then the market's pricing itself at about 8 trillion, and it varies around that market price. Today, it's at 178%. So it's at more than double what would be historically considered normal. And that's purely being driven by index investing being pushed in there as a result of having nowhere else to go. There's, you know, go buy a bond at zero interest rate, right? So this market is vastly, in my view, and I think in Buffett's view, it's vastly overpriced. It's an accident waiting to happen, and the accident finally happened. And now you're going to see the market reprice itself as people get out of those indexes. You have the opposite thing happen, which is nobody's checking price against value. And now the indexes have to sell off all those stocks in order to give you your money back.
In an indiscriminate way.
In an indiscriminate way, which is how it can move 37% in a month.
Yeah.
I mean, that's unbelievable volatility. And then back up in a matter of a few days. Unbelievable volatility as these indexes are just shoving money in or taking money out. So I think if you look at all of the different rational views of a market, the ultimate view of a market that makes sense to me is that a thing is worth some relationship to the cash it gives you back, right? I mean, if you buy a house to rent to somebody, you have to look at it in terms of your cash flow. At some point, you have to say, well, that's just too expensive. I'm not going to get enough rent back in here to use my money that way to justify the risk of a house versus putting my money in a T-bill. And so that relationship has been torn apart now. And it's about to go through, a very significant repricing. And when that happens, you're going to have bargains. Because then, as you have exuberance of the market always goes up, you can't worry, you just put the money in there. You have the opposite thing occur, which is, my God, all of my retirement savings are going away in my 401k. I've got to get the money out. And when that money starts coming out, again, the indexes are going down. And this is what Burry's concerned about. They'll be very volatile. And when that happens, you have fear start to rise, and then it goes through past the point of reasonable pricing as fear starts to tell everyone, get out, get out, get out. It goes right on past that into some unreasonable pricing the other direction. And that, I think, is what Buffett is kind of signaling he's waiting for.
Wow. So if we make this actionable, and actually before we get to that, I should explain to people, because we're talking about this a Dr. Michael Burry character, all you got to think of is Christian Bale in The Big Short. Yeah. And there you go.
Exactly.
If you didn't see The Big Short, go see it. Otherwise, just think Christian Bale and you're good. I'm sure. Or maybe not.
To put a point on it, he made like $1 billion, right? With a bunch of people screaming at him, give me my money back, you moron. He still went and made him $1 billion. And Burry is absolutely a guy that I track. I think if you want to watch somebody who's a brilliant investor, who might leave you puzzled about why he's doing certain things, he's a guy to watch. He's fun to watch.
His feelings about water, we can save that for a different show, but also fascinating. Just
fascinating.
Absolutely.
He and Ted Turner, by the way.
Oh, really? Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Ted's a big water owner.
Yeah. There are some people listening. I'm just thinking about somebody out walking the dog, taking the daily, got to get out of the house, walk, listening to you and I chat. And they're going, oh, I don't know this town guy, but he just sounds like he sounds like one of those active investors. An active investor lately means horrible to the indexer, right? We've had that.
Dancing in. We've had that in and out
over and over and over. And people missed, if they didn't hear you and I talk before, let's be clear, man, you really are not an active investor.
I'm a sit on my butt investor, capable of sitting on my thumbs and doing absolutely nothing for as much as 2 or 3 years at a time in cash, waiting patiently. And I would say I get very active sometimes. I'm basically passive aggressive with investing.
Yeah, that's a good way to put it.
Very, very, very passive until the market puts a bunch of things I want to own on sale, and then I'm very aggressive about loading up the truck. So no, I don't invest often, but I do invest aggressively sometimes.
Yeah, the rule one way, you have a set of signals, really filters that you follow to determine which companies are the companies that are in your wheelhouse, and then you wait for those to hit. So you, my understanding of your day, Phil, is this, and I'm probably making it easier than it seems. You, Melissa, wake up, you go have some breakfast, you go look at the computer, you look and see what your companies do. Maybe, I don't know if it's every day, if it's once a week, you look and see if any of your signals have hit, and then you go out and you spend your day with the horses.
Yeah, pretty close. The big difference is I probably spend 3 hours reading.
Yeah.
Sitting here and just reading about companies I want to own. For example, if I want to own a railroad company because I see Warren Buffett buying one and I'm curious, and because my grandfather worked for the railroad, my uncle worked for the railroad. So I'm like, that might be something I could come to understand a little bit. I'll go on Amazon and I'll buy 30 books on railroads, and I'll just kind of start reading them and just pour through them until either I realize the railroad thing is way too hard for me, or occasionally I'll look and say, oh no, I kind of get this intermodal freight thing. This is cool. I think I understand now why Warren is buying this, you know, and then I can start making some sense out of whether I could buy into that company. And I'll do that. I try to make it a routine to do 3 or 4 hours of reading a day. And I read Melissa to sleep at night. I will read. She actually asked me to read the 10 Ks to her.
Does she really?
Oh, yeah. Because they put her out. I mean, she is like,
I didn't say a 10K puts me out.
30 seconds, she's gone. It's better than any Ambien. There's nothing like reading a 10K to just drop it.
If you were a mutual fund guy, you could just pick up a prospectus and you're good to go.
You're good to go right there, you know, gone.
That is
so other than the reading part. Yeah, you got it right. I don't spend much time on the market. I do some cash flow related trades where I don't have a company. I have a company I want to buy, but it's not at the margin of safety price. And I will do some options around that to try to get it at that margin of safety price. And if I don't get it, I'm making cash. And that's a lot of fun to do that. But you're basically right. I don't spend hardly any time actually investing.
I think people have this view of active investing and what they think it should be. You're sitting at the computer all day pulling your hair out, and that's not the Phil Town lifestyle.
No, we went into cash pretty aggressively in 2007. I went on CNBC and on Closing Bell, and told Maria we're going to cash. And she was like, I thought you were a value investor. And what are you doing going to cash? Right. So I got the other end of it from her. And I said, no, I mean, everything's overpriced. I can't find anything I really like. And I'm seeing big guys leaving the market, and one of the indicators we've got. And we went out 18 months, just nothing, and just camped out. And I'm back in that mode now. I'm feeling pretty comfortable sitting on my butt, going watch the horses get born. This is good.
I was going to say, it's got to be a little cathartic. I mean, when you turn on the news and everything else is so bad all day.
Honestly, I feel torn because I was fortunate enough to get an education on the concept, like Nicholas Taleb, the concept of anti-fragile. By the way, I think one of the best books you can read about both structuring your life and your investments is Anti-Fragile by Nick Taleb, who's an NYU professor, but also he was a former options trader, and he really knows his business. And his concept is exactly Buffett's concept for investing in how I try to follow these guys, which is to own things that will get better in a really tough situation. Own stuff that's going to do well when it hits the fan. And that's what Taleb means by anti-fragile, not just something that will survive, but something that will actively become bigger and better coming out the other end. And that's what we try to target for our investments.
I was on my morning walk today listening to Tim Ferriss talk to Nick Kokonis from Alinea, the big Chicago restaurant, and talking about trying to revive restaurants. And he was talking about Taleb this morning and how important and how some of the stuff that Taleb wrote 10 years ago, 15 years ago is playing out, just completely playing out right now.
Yes, it is. What you're seeing is the, at least in the financial services world, is kind of the death of efficient market theory, which Taleb has been ringing the death knell on for several years now. He wrote Black Swan and he wrote Fooled by Randomness.
Yeah.
Both of which are pretty solid criticisms of efficient market theory. Efficient market theory, of course, as you know, just is everything is priced properly in the market all the time, because what moron would sell something for $100 that's worth $200, right? Not realizing that in the other market, the academics not realizing the market's a scary place. Yeah. And that people do emotional things all the time, especially when they're trying to protect their fund manager career. Yeah. So the result of that is there are opportunities for us. And if we are an anti-fragile type investor where we are waiting patiently for those opportunities to appear and not trying to chase the market, we're trying, as Warren's partner, Charlie Munger says, we're trying to be patient. He says, because we make money when we wait. We don't make money when we buy. We don't make money when we sell. It's all about the waiting. And for the last year, this has been very hard to wait. I mean, it's like the market's really priced high. It's going up. People feel, you know, like, oh, I'm missing out, right? You got all that scenario going.
Yeah, yeah.
And you're gonna have a lot of you are out there feeling that right now. Like, if I'm not in this market, here we go again. I'm gonna miss out. But I would just caution you that this time it might be different, and you might want to really be careful with money you can't afford to lose right now.
Where can you teach people more, Phil? Where do we go?
Well, we just virtualized our workshop. Up to this point, we've been happy to have people come in on full scholarships to attend our workshop in Atlanta, and we did it live once a month. And now we've gone virtual, and we're doing once a month a virtual workshop. You can get to it by going to rule1investing.com and just follow the links to it. We sell them out. And what we're doing online is we're going through 2.5 days of pretty intense training. We have different instructors doing different parts of the training. And then every hour or so, we have you with a coach that's going to be working with you in a small group of about 8 to 10 people and working through the exercises from the education you just got. And by the end of that 3 days, we will have started you on structuring a watch list of companies that you understand and understand why someone like Warren Buffett or me might be buying them. The last time we did this in this kind of economic environment, Joe, was in our first workshop we did in Singapore in June of 2009. And I had just come off of CNBC, right? Doing a series there. And so these students were in perfect timing. And we built a watch list. And that's what we do with this virtual workshop. We'll build a watch list of 10 companies from these students, each of them trying to find one company in that 3-day period. And we'll build this watch list of what we think are our students' best view of anti-fragile companies. That watch list from Singapore, in the 10 years that followed, it did 1,254% return.
Holy cow.
Stunning, right?
Holy cow.
$10,000 would have become $125,000. $100,000 became $1.2 million. When the market, which was stunning during that same 10-year period, turned that $10,000 into $30,000. So the difference is not exponential, but it's damn big, right? It's big. And it's worth, I think, taking a look to see if you can do this. I think it's worth it. So if you want to join us, we fill them up fast. So jump in there. We're deep into June at this point and headed for July.
We will link in the show notes at stackingbenjamins.com. And I'd also be remiss if we didn't talk about the podcast, man, where you and Danielle have a ton of fun.
My daughter beats me up.
She does beat you up
on a weekly basis.
I love that when Phil starts to rant, like she goes, like, Dad, you're ranting. I'm pulling you back. Or you accuse her of wanting to argue. And she's like, I don't want to argue. Okay, you're right. I want to argue.
Exactly. See, I made a mistake. This was a mistake. She went to college at a really good liberal arts college and got a degree in comparing religions. And then she looked around for a job and there were no jobs available to compare religions. Imagine that.
That's strange.
And so then she went to Oxford and got a master's degree, not in something useful, but in religious comparisons this time. And stunned to find out there were no jobs for Oxford master's degrees. And then she came to me and said, Dad, I think I better go to law school and get a real job. Great. So she goes to NYU Law, and this was the mistake. NYU Law taught her how to argue unemotionally and basically take apart my arguments.
Oh, no. Like,
just disassemble my arguments. And this was completely unfair, frankly. And so she... I was used to having a daughter who was a religious major, you know?
Like, and, damn and, it.
Yeah, I could say what I want. She'd be like, oh. And no more, man. Now she just climbs up my smokestack. So it's just...
She does.
Yeah. Yeah. So we discuss investing, and she will be on the side of all of you who are skeptical. She's right there with you.
Yeah, that's InvestEd. And wherever you're listening to us, just put in InvestEd and you'll find us. And usually, by the way, on the charts, I notice we're always like right next to each other too. We are. We always hang out with
Phil. We're proud of you guys hanging in there with us.
We do our best. I struggle. I high five Cheryl, my spouse, every day. And I'm like, look, we're still next to Phil Town. Hey, great catching up, man. Stay healthy.
Thanks, man. I appreciate you, and you're fantastic. And I listen to you guys, and you're wonderful. And so we'll return the favor. We got to get you out there again.
Oh yeah. We will mess it up.
Oh, good. Absolutely. Fantastic, Joe.
Hey, all you barbecue fans. It's Joe's mom's neighbor, Doug. This whole crew's worked up an appetite bringing you the first half of this show, and it looks like we're all ready to chow down on some delicious BBQ. Joe's mom's warmed up the brisket, the ribs, and the sausage, and the baked beans, and the coleslaw. Hey, Joe, how about that coleslaw, huh? No, I think it's still pretty damn funny. Then check out the old-fashioned cherry Kool-Aid and apple pie. But get this, in just a moment, I'm going to lay on the team my amazing piece of a resistance. Before I do that, though, let's chew on today's trivia question. What is the most popular type of food U.S. consumers use for grilling? I'll be back with your answer faster than you can salivate over my soon-to-be-announced mouth-watering main course.
I was talking to a friend of mine at the local Detroit TV station OG, and she was telling me about how their ratings are through the roof. And during the whole coronavirus scare, people looking for community and not looking for the national news, looking to see what's happening in my backyard, looking for the connection that we really don't feel anymore. And one of the frustrating pieces of this is the local sportscaster every day salutes another high school sports team that was really good and didn't get to play. And so going through all the list of seniors and the list of these kids, but time still moves on, as you know, and that means that maybe college is around the corner. And if so, if you are going for an education and you can't pay cash for it, that means you're going to have student loans. Don't just have student loans, have a student loan strategy. And the place to get that strategy is Student Loan Hero. When you go to Student Loan Hero, what you'll find is calculators, quizzes to see how much you know, things you really must read before jumping into any student loans, all the products that are out there, the different types of student loans. You want to know what you're getting into beforehand so you know how to get out. College is about two things. It's about learning, but it also, if you're going into debt, can be about return on investment. If you look at college as an investment, well, then certainly you want to look at refinancing opportunities, lowering your payments. Maybe it's going to take some debt forgiveness because times have been really hard on you now, like they have a lot of Americans. Income-driven repayment, parent plus loans, and even looking into defaults and delinquency, how those work. If you have any questions about student loans, the number one place we look, Student Loan Hero. Head to studentloanhero.com for more.
Hey there, trivia fans. It's your barbecue chef, Joe's mom's neighbor, Doug. And I know you've been waiting on pins and needles to hear about my incredible, delectable, some even say edible, mystery dish. Well, remember a couple months back when I had the brilliant idea to sell my scrumptious possum burger to Burger King? For some reason, not explained to me. BK passed on my brilliance. It was a total mystery. But I've been tweaking the recipe ever since. You heard it. Old Doug's about to be redeemed, people. possum is on the menu today, and I got to admit, boy, is it tasty. And now, before I head off to make everyone's taste buds sour, I misread the script there. I meant to say, before I make everyone's taste buds sore, here is today's trivia answer. Question was, what is the most popular type of food U.S. consumers use for grilling? Well, according to the impossible-to-pronounce Statistica.com, a whopping 72% of grillers have grilled up some dogs. Hot dogs, that is. But coming up with a very close second, 71% have reported grilling up some delicious steaks. Don't worry, investors. In 2021, I am confident possum will take its rightful place on top of that list. I'm off to delight some palates. See ya.
Yeah, I'm not going near that.
Is it possum or opossum? Because that may make a difference. Oh. One of them is a delicacy.
And the other's sleeping on the side of the road all the time with his feet in the air. Horrible. Ugh.
No bueno.
Probably not for me. Might be for you. Hey, he's cooking it up. So get yourself a little something, something.
Delicioso.
And I wonder how much of that is cultural. You know, I wonder if there's cultures where possum is a delicacy. Maybe he'll find the Burger Kings over in that area. We'll take them. But these kings aren't taking any of that. Hey, let's throw out the Haven Lifeline. Distract ourselves. Tackle some of life's most important questions. Our friends at Haven Life Insurance Agency, they put what I value first. If I got to eat possum, it's probably a lot of ketchup. I value a lot of ketchup. Oh, gee, maybe some salt.
Yeah, you put a little mayonnaise on that, a little mustard, maybe some pickles for the crunch. That way you don't know what kind of crunch. I don't know.
I think I just threw up in my mouth. That's it's actually, you value your loved ones and your time. That's why they've made buying quality term life insurance actually simple. I can see the next email from Brittany at Haven Life. Hey, don't mention possum when you're talking about Haven Life, please. Head to StackyBenjamins.com/Haven Life now for a free quote. Super simple application, getting simpler every day. Prices are affordable. All policies issued by their parent company, Mass Mutual, which of course is more than 160 years old. Today, we're going to turn to our Facebook group, The Basement, for our Haven Lifeline. Because, oh, gee, we got this question in there that was addressed to the group, but I thought it would be really interesting for our larger listening community. Jason wrote, I spoke with my father about his end-of-life plans. It seems that his retirement plan is to either work until he dies or move in with me if he's forced to retire. I'd rather not. I moved across the country for a reason, but I don't think he'll have anyone else financially capable of taking care of him. Even though I have a decade or more, he's 60. What should I do in preparation? Man, is that a difficult question. But thanks to Jason for bringing that up, because planning this stuff early, I think is answer number one.
Well, this has been something that has come up. We did a thing for the last 6 weeks or so, these 30-minute calls with people just to chat, you know, about whatever. And this has been a common question. One of the top questions anyway has been like some variation of, I'm trying to get my own stuff together, and then I've got this other person in my family who is not participating. And that other person sometimes is a parent. The thing is that you just can't force people to do stuff. You know, I mean, you can't force them to save. You can't force them to invest. And if dad's 60 and he doesn't want to do that, you know, or can't for whatever reason, you know, nothing you are going to talk about is going to make him do it. If you're thinking about it from your perspective in terms of like, how do you prepare for it? Because we're not going to let our parents, if we can help it, you know, live under a bridge. I think the best thing is to prepare like you would for any other sort of expense. If you know that there's going to be a college expense in your life and the tuition's $1,500 a month, you better figure out a way to live on $1,500 a month less. And the sooner that you can figure out how to do that, the better. Now, the reality is that assuming that dad has worked for his entire life, and it sounds like he has, you know, he'll be getting some income, you know, some Social Security income at least. Who knows how much that'll be. But a lot of this stuff, if you're looking at it from the perspective of like bringing someone else into your household, there's not a whole bunch of extra costs associated with that. You know, there's extra costs for certainly consumption, food, water, utilities to some degree, but it's not a ton more. You know, little things you can do to save money you know, you can share the same cell phone plan. We pay for my parents' cell phones, and it dawned on me that we were paying this gigantic bill to Verizon. And I'm like, well, why don't we just have them be on our plan? It's $20 more a month, you know? So that saved, you know, $100 a month, basically. So there's a lot of opportunity for efficiency in there as you start picking up expenses for other people that you care about. And then the last little bit of information that I can share is, you know, when people are used to being really tight with money. So let's say that dad retires, he's getting a Social Security, it's $2,000 a month, and that's all there is. If you can add $200 to that pot, so to speak, you just increased his income by 10%. And maybe $200 is not a lot of money to you. Maybe $500 isn't a lot on a monthly basis. But just remember that you can't compare your current lifestyle to theirs, because they're quite often not the same. You know, your budget might be $10,000 a month. That's your living expenses for all of your family stuff. And if you kick another $200 to somebody or $400 to somebody who is living on $2,000 a month, that's a really big difference. Anyways, I'm just kind of rambling here, I guess, a little bit, but I'm good at that.
Well, I think a couple of resources, because this is really an emotionally charged topic. I think it's difficult for people, even though a bunch of us tried on the Facebook page and OG, you're trying here, without knowing the personalities. I mean, a lot of this OG too is personality driven. So Cameron Huddleston came on the show. She wrote a fantastic book called Mom and Dad, We Need to Talk, which is about having these conversations, how to have them. I think more importantly, how not to have them. I think OG, a big thing here is how not to have it. Don't you?
Well, yeah. And the reality is that, again, you're not going to convince them. Listen, people who get to be 60 years old, it's not lost on them that they don't have any money. You going, hey, you need to be doing this, is not going to engender a lot of goodwill. They get it. They understand. You don't need to shame them into it.
Hey, thanks to Jason for bringing that to our community. By the way, if you want to hang out with the entire Stacking Benjamins team throughout the week and a lot of our friends hang out there, it is such a good time. You have to like a lot of bad dad jokes along with your money talk. We don't talk big time economics. We do not talk politics. One of the few places I found online where we just don't do any of that. Mom demands that we do none of that. Head to stackybenjamins.com/basement, and that'll take you to the Facebook group. You click the button, answer a few questions to make sure that you're not some robot wanting to spam all of our friends. And Gertrude, mom's friend Gertrude, will open the door and let you in. All right, that's going to do for today. Hey, big thanks. A lot of people to thank here. I mentioned on Monday our thanks to the Westwood One team. Today, I'd like to thank people that leave us a review of this here show, because just taking that little bit of extra time to tell people what they're getting into when they listen to Stacking Benjamins does take some time. And it doesn't have to be super long. 5 stars from J. Chris Sean. Just says, my favorite financial podcast, period. 5 stars. That's it. Mom is very proud of that one today. Thank you so much for taking the time to leave us a review. All right. That's going to do it. Doug, you've got it from here, man. What should we have learned today?
Yep. I got it, Joe. First, take a lesson from our headlines. You are never truly in control of your credit card rates or limits, so avoid relying on credit cards to fund your lifestyle at all costs. Second, take a lesson from Phil Town. Thinking about trading? Maybe beginning with a plan and working that plan is the way to invest for the future, not asking about what's hot or not. But the big takeaway? Don't ever try to do something nice for these jokers, like a good old-fashioned possum dinner. Not only did they try to accuse me of poisoning them, apparently a few bad apple possums get rabies. I mean, like, who knew? It could happen to anybody, really. But they said the possum recipe isn't good. Possum recipe's not good. It's impossible. I shouldn't be surprised, though. I mean, not many people have the sophisticated palais like I do, like moi. Special thanks to Phil Town for joining us while social distancing. You'll find all of Phil's information at rule1investing.com or on our show notes page at stackingbenjamins.com. Phil also has a podcast called InvestEd, and you can find that where all the finer podcasts are distributed. This show is created by Joe Saul-Sehy, produced by Taylor Stevens, and engineered by the amazing Steve Stewart. Online, visit us on Twitter at SBenjaminsCast or on our Facebook page. I'm Joe's mom's neighbor, Doug, and I'm pretty much the guy in charge of everything around here. Trust me, this well-oiled machine didn't get like this all by itself. SB Podcasts may receive payment on the show from sponsors and guests in the form of books, giveaway items, discounts, or other remunerations. That's a big word. There's no way you take advice from these dorks, but like Joe's mom always says, don't take advice from people you don't know. This show is for entertainment purposes only. And before making any financial decisions, consult with a real financial advisor.
Okay, I mentioned earlier that I was going to tell a story, and I don't remember what that is. So when I go back to listen to this and clean it up, we'll figure out what story it was. And if it, apparently it wasn't worth it, OG, because I don't remember. But it is amazing what you find yourself doing when you're huddled at home. And I wanted to tell you one thing I've been doing lately. I'm a big baseball fan, and I found a baseball simulation game. No baseball on TV, so I decided to do this simulation. It's called Out of the Park Baseball. You make yourself a manager and a general manager of a team. And of course, being a Detroit Tigers guy, I decided that I would manage the Detroit Tigers. This game isn't a game. I got completely fooled by the game. This is a full-time job because not only do I control ticket prices at the stadium, I also make all the trades. I bring guys up and down from the minors during every game. I call plays. I don't do the batting, and I'm constantly swearing at my guys, but I also get directions from the owner. So Chris Illich, the owner of the Detroit Tigers, wrote me at the beginning of the season. And what's hilarious is how realistic this game is. Because for people that aren't baseball fans, the Detroit Tigers have been horrible, just absolutely horrible. And my game opens up with an email from Chris Illich. You know what it said? My job for this year, OG, is, and I quote from the game, just don't completely suck.
It's like the tagline for the podcast.
I got that email and I thought, man, that is just truth. That is my goal. If you're managing the Tigers, I just don't want to completely suck. And so immediately I realized that I've got all these issues. Talk about money issues. The reason I bring this up is because I've got money issues. So I've got $4 million that I can spend on free agents, which for you and I, that is a ton of money. For MLB, that's not a bunch. I fire my pitching coach to get a better one who works great with young pitchers because I have to go young and develop a team. I try to trade my top guy who makes $20 million a year. And this is me screaming at my computer, OG, why are we paying baseball players $20 million a year? That's amazing. And especially when I'm the GM. So I tried to trade him to the New York Mets, who, by the way, way better team this year. We're going to be a better team this year than Detroit was going to be. Chance of winning. And guess what Miguel Cabrera does? He enacts his no trade clause. I can't trade him.
He gets to stay.
Why do you want to stay with my crappy team? You're costing me $20 million a year. The dudes playing next to him are making what's league minimum, like 525. I got guys all over my infield making 525,000. He's making, I could hire 40 of these dudes. Anyway, my team is 4-6.
Just under 500. Not terrible.
There's this stat that Steam's the engine that runs the games and it on your computer, and it tells you how long you've been playing. I've owned the game 2 weeks, 30 hours. It's a full-time job. I have to stop. It's not good. Out of the park baseball. Actually, it is really good. If you're missing baseball and you really want into some of that nitty gritty, I've made a couple trades. I got hoodwinked. I trade my closer. You know why I trade my closer? He was the best player on my team.
Copies for closers?
Dude, on the Detroit Tigers, you know how often he was playing? How many games does my closer get to close? Joe Jimenez was not closing any games because my team sucks. I have been in 9 games and I got to use him once. So I thought, I'm going to trade him for a couple guys that can get in the game. Listen, if I'm lucky enough to be in a game in the 9th inning, I will figure it out. But I got to get to that point where I'm in more games in the 9th inning. So I went to trade him for a good relief pitcher, just a regular relief pitcher, and for a new shortstop. Jordy Mercer, good with the bat, total liability at shortstop. The number of times he just lets the thing go through his legs is just absolutely horrible. And by the way, Castellanos in right field, maybe the best player on my team, even in right field, he's so slow to get the ball. I've had so many base hits to right field. But every time he comes up to bat, the dude's gold. Anyway, so I trade.
DH, dude.
I trade this. That's what I need to do. I trade him for 2 younger guys. And then I find out this game has a little bit of a fog of war. Neither of these guys, when they get on my team, is as good as my scouting organization thought they were. So I totally get hosed on this trade. Anyway, that's how you feel coronavirus time.
I'm going outside and exercising, but you do that. That sounds way better.
Oh, I've been doing that too. I'm doing this race across Tennessee. My legs are killing me. You know how hard it is to go over 5 miles every single day?
I do. Because when I do my after school activity, sometimes I'll do that like 3 days in a row.
You'll wear like a Fitbit and see how many miles you logged?
Yeah. Yeah. It works out to be about, it depends, but it's probably around 6 miles a day, Thursday, Friday, Saturday. Yeah. So by the time Sunday rolls around, I can't move.
No, we'll try to walk and run. What I like to do is walk 3 and run 4 and get in 7 in the day so I can take a day off every once in a while. Today, I'm just going to walk 3. In fact, here, as soon as we're finished recording, I'm going to go out and walk 3 with Cheryl. But good times.
Sounds fun. Have a good walk.
Well, I hope you got a lot out of today's episode. But one thing that we talked about a little bit today, but we talk about a lot, is you got to have good partners on your team, Stackers. And you know what? Navy Federal Credit Union could be that partner, because becoming a member at Navy Federal Credit Union could help you earn more and save more. And aren't those 2 of the big tenets, right? Have a debt strategy, earn more, save more. Their certificate options could earn you more than standard savings accounts with competitive rates. Not all financial institutions offer you as many choices for savings options as Navy Federal does. For example, you can start your savings journey with a low minimum deposit, add money at any time, and watch your savings grow. I think that's the coolest certificate. Thanks to flexible terms, you can use Navy Federal savings options for all kinds of goals, short or long term. Considering a big home improvement project? Maybe you want to consolidate debt. Well, as you're putting your plan together, you want to also have a debt strategy, right? And you could borrow up to 100% of your home's equity with a fixed rate home equity loan with 0 closing cost, or easily borrow as you go with a home equity line of credit. Don't get in over your head with debt. Make sure you have a great strategy and then take out debt as you need it. And Navy Federal's options certainly give you the flexibility to help you make life's big expenses seem more manageable. To learn more, visit NavyFederal.org. At Navy Federal, our members are the mission. Navy Federal is insured by NCUA, equal housing lender, membership required, terms and conditions apply, loan subject to approval.